Since opening our doors about 6.5 years ago, we have treated almost 3,000 fire service members. We take very seriously the need to vet clinicians for cultural competence. Not every single mental health clinician is equipped to be of the best service for fire service members and their families. And we do have the ability to treat that co-occurring substance abuse through full supervised medical detox and then all of the stepping down levels of care. There is a thread of connection between fire service members, and it's something that is understood on campus. But they highlighted how so much of the treatment process for them was doing it alongside the brothers and sisters of the fire service.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience, along with my co-host, Stacey Raymond. I'm David Dashinger. In this episode, we'll be speaking with Hannah Elmore, MSW, from the IAFF Center of Excellence and the Fortitude Program. We'll be speaking about the IAFF Center of Excellence, navigating behavioral healthcare system, addressing compassion fatigue and burnout in the fire service, and building coping skills.
We'll also be bringing you a new installment of Resilience Toolbox, looking at how first responders can protect against on-the-job sun exposure and reduce damaging UV rays that can cause skin cancer.
Please like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and Responder TV, UBS Radio, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all the podcast platforms, and our website is respondertv.com. We'll be right back to speak with Hannah after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Responder Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacey Raymond, and Bonnie Lumley, LCSW EMTB.
Today we're joined by Hannah Elmore, who's a clinical social worker serving first responders on the outreach team for the IAFF Center of Excellence. The IAFF Center of Excellence is a one-of-a-kind treatment facility specializing in PTSD for professional fire service members who struggle with trauma, substance abuse, and other related behavioral health challenges. Hannah works with first responders through connection to behavioral health resources, providing education, and offering support. Hannah educates on behavioral health topics pertaining to the fire service and first responder communities. She does that to departments, peer teams, families, and clinicians. Hannah, a warm welcome to Respond to Resilience.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to be here and sharing this space with both of you today.
So Hannah, I'd like to start out by asking you if you could just give us a little bit of background on your training and how you became a behavioral health advocate for the fire service and other first responders.
Absolutely. So my background is in clinical social work. Prior to joining this team, I worked more in a clinical social work realm with individuals and families, providing support and providing some of those clinical services. My clinical training is rooted in healthcare and other nonprofit settings. And I actually started working within the first responder realm, actually with veterans at the Veterans Affairs Hospital here in Tampa Bay. And a lot of my clinical training as a master's level social work was actually done at the VA hospital. Prior to joining this team, I have committed myself each and every day to growing in immersion and cultural competency working with first responders. I take my opportunity to be able to support first responders very seriously and recognize, not being a first responder myself, there's a lot of work I need to do each and every day to be a trusted resource. So in doing so, since joining this team, I have undergone trainings as well as different opportunities for immersion in the first responder culture to be a better resource and to be able to better assist in those behavioral health needs. Some of those are, I have been certified as an IAFF peer support I'm an IAFF peer supporter. I've gone through another IAFF training for clinicians in treating fire service members in behavioral health settings. I've gone through a fire ops immersion experience, as well as many different ride-alongs with fire departments in over a multitude of different states. And I continue to schedule those and look forward to any opportunities each and every day working with fire service and first responder culture.
My hat's off to you for doing all that immersion, because we know how important it is to be culturally competent and understand, you know, the world of firefighters, since we're focusing really on more on the fire service today. Can you talk a little bit about some of the experiences you had doing ride-alongs and, you know, fire ops? Like, what did you take away from that that you maybe didn't know before you had all those opportunities?
Sure. So I would start off by saying, in the fire ops program, more in the structured training that I went through, being able to really get my hands on the tools that are used for vehicle extrication exercises and the fire extinguishment and search and rescue, and really feeling the experiences, although it's a simulation, but the weight of the materials and the heat of the fire and the heaviness and the just the feeling of even just the bunker gear and really going into that immersive experience was really eye-opening for me, never to have experienced that type of situation, as well as during that fire ops training, hearing from fire service members that were sharing specific stories that they recalled in relation to certain calls related to the exercise we were doing that induced trauma in them, and really hearing that real life experience alongside that opportunity. Now, with the ride along, I think just really the day-to-day culture became a lot more clear to me, being on ride alongs and hearing the tones and the rush of getting out onto the truck and really making it to the scene as quickly as possible, and seeing firsthand real life crisis situations that civilians are engaged in, and really how they lean so heavily on the first responders that arrive on scene, to some of the lighter, I guess, cultural sense of the dinner table and the story shared around, and how close everybody was and the trust built within just the community there. So really being firsthand and being able to experience that and continuing to do so has really helped solidify within me a greater understanding of not only the day-to-day job, but really the relationship and the culture amongst all, everybody involved.
That sounds great. Yeah. So if you could just tell us a little bit about the IAFF Center for Excellence, you know, what are its different components?
Absolutely. So the IAFF Center of Excellence is a partnership between the International Association of Firefighters Union and Advanced Recovery Systems, which is a behavioral health treatment company with 10 civilian substance abuse treatment facilities throughout North America. The IAFF approached Advanced Recovery Systems about 7 years ago to create a firefighter-specific behavioral health treatment facility. Everyone on campus receiving behavioral health treatment at the Center of Excellence is exclusively an IAFF firefighter or fire service member, both active and retired. Having the firefighter-specific culture has really helped to build on the camaraderie that is already in existence in the fire service and in the IAFF, and really provides that opportunity for connection and growth within that brother and sisterhood alongside the treatment process. We're duly licensed for primary mental health and primary substance abuse at the Center of Excellence. So individuals coming onto campus may or may not have a substance abuse component and may just be coming in for primary mental health concerns. But we do have that full continuum of care available if that substance abuse component is present. Mental health concerns that we commonly see on campus are, of course, post-traumatic stress, complicated grief, anxiety, depression, social anxiety, OCD, among others. And then we do have the ability to treat that co-occurring substance abuse through full supervised medical detox, and then all of the stepping down levels of care that I'd love to go into a little bit later, but just to give that, you know, brief introduction to it. Since opening our doors about 6.5 years ago, we have treated almost 3,000 fire service members. We've had a fire service member come in from every single state in the United States, as well as 3 provinces in Canada. So we're very thankful for the trust and the partnership that we have with local leadership and peer support teams to trust us with their membership. It's located in Upper Marlboro, Maryland, which is about 45 minutes outside of Washington, D.C. And we do have individuals from the center that will come to the airport to pick up every member that's flying in to ensure a safe transition into treatment upon arrival.
I've heard anecdotally from people who are, you know, on that precipice of going to inpatient care that there's a lot of fear, a lot of, you know, trepidation about, you know, what's going to happen when they get there. Can you speak a little bit about what somebody can expect if they take that giant leap to get help? What's it like to go into one of these facilities and get that care?
Absolutely. So I'll start from the admissions process and kind of build from there to be able to paint the picture. So if somebody is interested in coming into the Center of Excellence or has questions about what that looks like, we encourage them to connect with myself or another member of the outreach team or directly with our admissions team, and we will address every single question or any trepidation that they have to better help them to prepare for this step. When they come into treatment, they will go through a full medical assessment to make sure that every single need that they have is addressed and created in a treatment plan with an agreement between the client, the nursing staff, clinical staff, medical staff. We really want everyone to be on board to make sure that every single need of this individual is met. But bringing it back a little bit in terms of calling into admissions, the first step that we do is we run medical insurance. We are a medical treatment facility, so we do run through medical insurance, and I can give a greater explanation of that as well. But that's the first step that we do just to determine that there's no barriers for any insurance situations and that we can get that cost breakdown in the hands of the member as soon as possible to give them the most comprehensive idea of what this would cost and how we can set them up for success with payment. Once that is completed, we go through, it's about a 15-20 minute pre-assessment over the phone with one of our intake coordinators over in our admissions team that goes over really the whole person perspective of the individual. We want to look at medical history, psychological history, substance abuse history, family history. We want to be sure that we're kind of encapsulating every component of an individual so we can make sure that we're the best care for their needs. Once we collect all that information, it is sent over to our medical team. Our medical director, Dr. Abby Morris, is a psychiatrist, and she does review each and every individual's case before we offer that approval for admission into our center, so we can be positive that once they arrive, they're approved to arrive on campus, that it will be the best fit for their treatment. So once that is all approved, and once we have that, we can look at scheduling. Our admissions team assists with all logistics of travel, figuring out flights and driving and what does that look like, as we don't want that to be an additional stressor for an individual seeking treatment or for whoever that support person is calling in for them seeking treatment. So our team takes on a lot of that logistics planning and trying to make it as seamless and easy as possible.
So are most insurances accepted? And what do you do in the case of somebody's insurance is not accepted by IIFF? Are there any scholarships, money available to help those individuals?
So I'll start off with the insurance approval process. Most insurances we're a network with. And what we've done over the last 6.5 years is really worked to develop those contracts with all the most major insurances such as Aetna, Cigna, United Healthcare, Blue Cross Blue Shield, among others, to make sure that there's the highest likelihood of insurance approval and a positive insurance benefit to come back for the lowest cost as possible, being a network for the member. Now, let's say, for example, we run into a situation where an individual has maybe a smaller insurance plan or an HMO plan. Let's say, for example, for the sake of this conversation, somebody has Blue Cross Blue Shield, which we're in network with, but maybe it's a Blue Cross Blue Shield HMO plan. HMO plans often have state restrictions tied to them. So let's say they're not living in the state of Maryland, they have an HMO plan, and that does not allow them to leave the state of their residence for treatment. Some situations that we are able to kind of work through could be working for a single case agreement through the insurance company, which we've done successfully in the past, and we will put all of our tenacity to do so and get that approval for a member that maybe has a restricted plan with their permission and with their willingness to be on board with us pursuing that process. So that's something that we will work for, is that single case agreement. And my team has been able to really work through some sticky insurance, smaller plans in the past. Now, in terms of funding, if funding resources are needed, we can look at local nonprofit organizations we're connected with, nationwide organizations we're connected with. And then also each local operates a little bit differently. And there's actually a lot of locals that have benevolent funding set aside to assist with members that are seeking admission, whether it's assisting with deductibles or flight costs or whatever that financial need is. if they are willing to lean on the local for that assistance, oftentimes we're able to tap into that as well, as long as the member provides that permission to involve the local.
Before we, we're going to get back to this later on to kind of ask where we can get in touch with you, where people can find you or reach out. But let's do it now as well, since this is very important. If someone needs help or they want to find out more about the program, what's the best way to get in touch?
Absolutely. So we do have an admissions team that operates 24/7. We know that a lot of times mental health and behavioral health crises do not arise during typical business hours. So we want to be sure that we have that accessibility for individuals that are calling in. So our admissions team is available 24 hours a day. Myself, I also would love to be involved in the process to be able to keep the individual apprised of the process. So you can reach out to me directly. But if I may, our admissions number for somebody that's seeking that 24-hour admissions entry would be 855-441-3024. And then at the end, I'll also share my personal cell phone number as well to be able to be a resource for all of you.
Okay, great. Yeah, we'll put that up on the screen. And speaking of, these circumstances where someone needs to reach out, how can we identify an acute emergency in ourselves or if someone we know is going through something?
Absolutely. So what's interesting is, not all the time do first responders have the same symptoms of a mental health decline or a crisis as maybe a civilian would. First responders are very high functioning. So I hear oftentimes that it's hard to see through that mask that maybe first responders are really apt to putting on and really putting on that front. I think a blend of stigma and a blend of that feeling of needing to always have it together to serve others can kind of make it more difficult to identify when there maybe is a decline in mental health or when that crisis does arise.
Yeah.
It can also look like being always on the go or ignoring and detaching and maybe stuffing feelings to kind of keep going and kind of keep pushing away those symptoms. But when we look at more of a behavioral health crisis symptoms or maybe even suicide risk symptoms that we may see, this could look like increased irritability, anger outbursts, hostility towards others, aggression. Maybe we'll see an increase in risk-taking behaviors or impulsivity, increased use of substances. And we know that there is that correlation, strong correlation between substance abuse and alcohol use disorder and suicide risk, post-traumatic stress disorder and suicide risk, and major depressive disorder and suicide risk as well. If I may, my brain, when I think about this, kind of goes to the stress continuum model, which is a really interesting way to illustrate different signs and symptoms that we may identify in ourselves and others, depending on where we're kind of falling on this stress continuum. I like to use the stress continuum model, and I encourage peer teams to possibly use it as a check-in tool as well to help kind of provide common language to stress reactions or to really just better identifying and putting language to how we're feeling.
Right.
There's, if you Google online, there's different examples of the stress continuum model. There's actually one that is for first responders and really has more of that first responder catered idea to it. But signs that an individual maybe is creeping towards the higher level of the crisis or critical level of a stress reaction could be more of that increased substance use, hopelessness, feeling lost and out of control. Maybe they're exhibiting more signs of blame, hiding out, withdrawal, absenteeism, poor concentration. And then we often also see signs of depression and other behavioral health conditions may present as marital problems or disciplinary issues or legal concerns such as DUIs or interpersonal concerns. So a lot of times it can be, I guess, camouflaged, not recognizing that it is maybe a mental health condition or the beginning of the development of one, but it's being exhibited through other areas of life that are becoming more of a struggle.
So another symptom, I don't know if you mentioned it or not, is the difficulty sleeping. Mm-hmm. There's changes in their sleep patterns and possibly the nightmares that they might experience. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about a concept of compassion fatigue, burnout, what the difference is between the two. What do you notice among firefighters?
Absolutely. So I think compassion fatigue and burnout are sometimes used interchangeably, but they definitely have their differences. When we look at compassion fatigue, we're looking more at that empathy fatigue. We're looking at that chronic exposure to others in crisis or others having these major life situations and showing up day after day and being exposed to these potentially traumatic events can really cause that compassion fatigue within an individual. And it's not just for first responders. You know, we also may see this in other forward-facing jobs such as social work and palliative care and nurses and doctors and emergency care workers. And so it's really, it can affect the way an individual operates as well. One example that I've heard first responders use in the past is they come home from shift and they have a young kiddo and their kiddo falls and skins their knee and their kiddo comes to them for comfort and they're having a really hard time feeling empathy for their child, not because they don't love their child or because they don't want to have empathy for their child, but they're having that compassion fatigue due to unmanaged, exposure and lack of processing and really working through that exposure. So some signs we can see in individuals that might have compassion fatigue could be that numbness or that detachment from emotions, maybe withdrawal from others, absenteeism from work, decreased or poor patient satisfaction or patient care, which can definitely lead to job-related disciplinary actions as well, if that's starting to affect the job, increased errors at work, increased use of drugs and alcohol, and some of that poor concentration. Now, when we look at burnout, burnout is oftentimes more related to the stress of the workplace itself. Maybe it's chronic, unmanaged stress of heavy workloads, unpredictable environments, lack of appreciation from others, unfavorable working conditions, vicarious trauma, compassion fatigue, and other situations, which we know a lot of times come with the territory of the job and are hard to not be exposed to, but it's about kind of learning the coping skills to manage and keep that at bay. But with burnout, we may see exhaustion or additional sleep disturbances, heightened emotional responses, suspicion or paranoia, those physical complaints, and then the increased substance use as well. But one thing I find interesting about compassion fatigue and burnout, not being a diagnosable mental health condition, but lead to a mental health condition if left unmanaged.
Right. And I feel for first responders when they are exposed, the fact that they're exposed to such extreme situations, you know, might be a car accident where somebody has broken bones or they're missing a limb or something like that. And then when they come home and their child skins their knee, it just, relatively speaking, it just seems like such a small incident, kind of like, pick yourself up. Come on, you know, don't cry. Right. You're okay. You don't need to go to the hospital. Right. So there's that detachment begins as the first responder is desensitized to what is really an emergency, right? And that child feels like it's an emergency because they have blood flowing, you know, from their cut. And now their first responder parent is not really all that surprised or alarmed or anything like that. So there's that kind of breach of empathy.
Absolutely. So, and if I may add on to that, one thing I've noticed and heard from individuals too is that constant exposure to these potentially traumatic events and these crisis emergencies, it's leading individuals to sometimes having that negativity bias or maybe always expecting the negative because they're seeing so much of that negative. Right. And it can be hard to come out of that feeling if we're kind of always set up for, you know, when's the other shoe going to drop and when's the next crisis going to come? It can be hard to kind of reframe and reframe our brain to looking at the positive again. And that's something that we talk about a lot with prevention of burnout and compassion fatigue and how we can treat this is how can we reframe and begin to feel more self-awareness of maybe that negativity bias that we're falling into and really kind of picking ourselves back up to prevent continuing that negative outlook. But you're right. It kind of naturally can arise just from the constant crisis and emergency situations.
And I think it also carries over to the spouses, right? When there's a problem at home that to them is an emergency, an appliance or a plumbing problem, to the responder who's coming home from 12 calls and, you know, cardiac arrests and MVAs and structure fires, that the clogged sink is not, not registering as a big problem in their mind. And I'm wondering, so you mentioned that compassion fatigue and burnout is not sort of like a diagnosis per se, but is it treatable? How can responders get help if they're experiencing those challenges?
Absolutely. And it's not something that once an individual feels this, they will forever feel this, or they have to quit their job. I mean, there's definitely ways that we can work around this to bring ourselves back to baseline and operate at our highest level. This could look like establishing and maintaining boundaries. Maybe it's boundaries at work, boundaries at home, kind of finding ways to communicate when I need to take a step back or when I need to maybe take a day off, practicing stress reduction techniques and mindfulness, and being better able to identify when am I finding myself having higher levels of stress reactions or stress symptoms, and I need to maybe develop greater self-awareness of when I need to take a step back and reevaluate to bring myself back to baseline. This can look like cultivating a strong social and professional support system, you know, finding that individual, whether it's within your family, whether it's a peer team member, for that social support, and then professional support through the utilization of a clinician or other type of support group. Talking with a professional and really finding what coping strategies work for you. You know, what coping strategies work for me may not work as effectively for you. And there's nothing wrong with that, but we're different people and we kind of have to find what is a strategy I can lean on comfortably that I can call upon when needed and I know will be effective for me. But I think a lot of it does fall into that self-awareness and that, you know, maintaining, being emotionally aware of how we can tell and we can identify when we start to kind of fall back and decline, to bring ourselves back to where we want to be.
Right. We talk about this a lot, but it always seems to circle back to leadership and the company officer, having a good read on his members and knowing what to look for, or being able to resource if they do sense there's a problem in one of their members, being able to get them the help or have the conversation with them, at least just to get a little deeper into understanding what's going on with that member. So sometimes we're maybe not the most self-aware and our best advocates, but the company officer and the leadership can take on a bigger role to advocate for their people.
Absolutely. And you bring up such a good point of, sometimes it's hard for us to recognize within ourselves, maybe when we need that support, but having that greater awareness and understanding of signs and symptoms of stress reactions and potential, mental health conditions that are arising, and then having that ability to call upon, does this require a crisis resource right now? Does this require a local therapist resource, or does this require inpatient treatment? And how can I best serve this individual with whatever need they have? Do I have that toolbox to be able to kind of work through and provide them that support? I think is really important too.
I think that's really where peer support fills in, right? It's kind of that middle ground between, inpatient treatment, substance abuse treatment, where you have people that are trained in-house to kind of be aware of changes in behavior, mm-hmm. and having the courage and the compassion to approach someone who just doesn't seem to be right. Hey, what's, approach them in a private situation, just a little concerned. You seem to be, taking a lot of sick days, or you're just not as talkative as used to be. I'm just mm-hmm. checking in, just seeing if everything is okay. Mm-hmm. And starting that conversation, that's kind of a nice way to, keep an eye on, your brothers and sisters, mm-hmm. but there's no sense of panic because, you don't have to rush to treatment, right. But it can open a conversation. It can get the first responder to kind of look at themselves like, wow, maybe I am behaving differently. And then they start considering how they're behaving at home, what their sleeping is like, what mm-hmm. their substance use is like. So
absolutely.
Peer support.
And peer support really normalizes a lot of what's going on too, where they jump in and they are able to provide that validation of, hey, what you're feeling is a normal reaction to what's going on, and how can I help you, and how can I point you in the right direction, rather than, an advice giving or, somebody saying, this is what you need to do. Peer support really takes that back and says, how can I be of service to you? And what do you need from me right now? How can I help you get there with that? Perspective of validation, I think is so powerful, and having somebody that really gets it and mm-hmm. is in your shoes can really be the support somebody needs to move forward.
On this installment of Resilience Toolbox, we're speaking with Melissa Allen, who's an entrepreneur, human biologist, and allied healthcare professional, about how sun exposure presents unique challenges to first responders and military. And we'll look at ways to do a better job of protecting our skin from damaging UV rays that can cause cancer. Please share a little bit about your background and your connection to the first responder and military community.
Yeah, sure, David. Well, previously I was an EMT for a short period of time, and I was also on the volunteer fire department at Riverview, Florida, also for a short period of time, before relocating here to San Diego area. And I'm now a human biologist. I run a small health and wellness studio here in San Diego. And then my husband is a 14-year Navy veteran, and he is now a helicopter mechanic at North Island, also here in San Diego.
Tell us a little bit about the way that you came to create cover. How did that all come about?
Well, my husband and I were conservationists. We're outside a lot, spend a lot of time outdoors. And my husband's fair complexed, and he never really wanted to wear sunscreen. And honestly, I could have been probably doing a better job of applying it myself. One day we're hanging out in the living room, and our puppy starts walking along the top of the couch, kind of like a cat. And my husband's starting to get a little bit bald up there, and he starts licking his head, excuse me, obsessively. And it just kind of made us, you know, take note. And he was going, Bodie, knock it off, you know, knock it off. And it just continued the next day. And that's when we thought we'd better take a closer look at it. He asked if I saw anything up there. And I said, well, honestly, it just looks like a tiny ingrown hair, possibly. But given that Bodie was so strange about it, I said, you ought to make an appointment with a dermatologist. And one thing led to another. He ended up getting a diagnosis of basal cell carcinoma. And thank God it was able to be removed. He's doing fine.
So we do often hear about UV rays and their role in causing skin cancers. Why do first responders need to make this kind of skin protection a priority?
Well, first of all, like, they're outside a lot, right? They're in all elements. They're usually sweating. That's another thing. So when you're sweating, if you did have sunscreen on, you could be losing it that way. So our sunscreen is water resistant as well. One of the best things would be is just to apply sunscreen before you find yourself in an emergency situation.
Right. We do see, you know, law enforcement personnel spending a lot of time outdoors for extended hours. And I just learned today a study that looked at Florida firefighters found an elevated risk for skin cancer compared to the general population. What's unique about cover, and how does it work?
Well, cover is a mineral formula versus a chemical formula. So there's two major types of sunscreen out there. The mineral formula is a lot healthier for the person that's applying it. So it's known not to disrupt hormone levels and endocrine levels. That would take a while to go into detail about that. But out of two, it's much healthier. It's also healthier for the oceans as well. And then SPF factors, like an SPF 30, we feel that it's better designed for people that sweat and move outdoors versus like an SPF 100. Most people think like an SPF 60 would be twice as much protection as 30, but that's not the way it works. SPF 30 blocks 97% of harmful UV rays. So in our eyes, that's the best of both worlds. So you have something that feels breathable for your skin, as well as getting maximum protection.
Are there any other strategies you can share about making sure we protect our skin from UV rays?
Trying to also reapply if you do find yourself sweating more than usual. Try to reapply it. If you can do it every 2 hours, that's even better.
If someone's interested in checking out or purchasing cover, how can they find it?
You can go to cover.responderTV.com. You can get a 15% discount.
Melissa, thank you so much for joining us on Resilience Toolbox and sharing your mission with cover. We appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you very much for having me, David.
Congratulations, Responder Resilience, on your 100th episode, and thank you for the impact you are making on the industry.
Welcome to Responder Resilience, along with my co-hosts, Dr. Stacey Raymond and Bonnie Romoli. I'm David Dashinger.
A huge shout out for David, Bonnie, and Stacey for the 100th episode of Responder Resilience.
Hey, congratulations, Responder Resilience, on your 100th episode. Looking forward to another 100.
It just occurred to me that IAFF has an amazing variety and number of courses for sort of building your toolbox for these topics we're talking about, Hannah. Like, can you talk a little bit about some of the training that's available for firefighters and other people, maybe peer support people?
Absolutely. So the IAFF offers a peer support class for individuals that departments can host for their entire membership, or they can be inviting in others from locals and other departments to do a two-day intensive peer support training with role play opportunities and the opportunities to have these discussions of behavioral health to develop that structured class. Beyond that, the IAFF offers additional training such as resiliency training and addressing suicide in the fire service and other types of helpful formalized trainings. Now, what we do at the IAFF Center of Excellence is we try to provide additional trainings on top of that, or supplemental trainings, to be able to have accessible and on demand for individuals within peer teams, as well as just members of the fire service and their families. So we offer webinars that we host twice a month, live webinars of all different types of behavioral health topics under the sun related to the fire service and first responder community. These webinars can be for disorders and really breaking down different disorders such as alcohol use disorder and major depressive disorder and very common disorders and situations that we see in the fire service. Mm-hmm. Other topics are how to build an effective behavioral health program. And okay, you have these peer supporters, and what do we do next? And how do we kind of develop next steps for the department? We're actually hosting that one on August 4th this week. So that one will be available online to review later as well. We have a webinar on navigating insurance and PPO versus HMO plans, and how do I help my members to decipher which plan is best for them for behavioral health treatment, and so on. I believe we have about 3 years worth of behavioral health online trainings that are available for free for individuals, peer teams, clinicians, and families to continue to increase cultural competency with behavioral health issues related to the fire service, as well as to be tools that can be utilized within peer support teams to help them to develop their behavioral health program and build that toolbox.
Check it.
So with having a firefighter-only program, can you just outline, just specify the advantages of that, and are there any disadvantages to that?
Sure. So I would say, starting off, we know that a lot of fire service members work in, as EMTs and paramedics, and they are constantly running individuals to their local hospitals, to their local treatment facilities. So to have a firefighter-specific program where there is no concern of running into any civilians that you have gone on any calls for or with, not going to the same facilities that you have run individuals to, has been very beneficial, not only for confidentiality purposes, but to maintain that sense of professionalism and really having that highest level of quality of care for fire service members, and knowing that they are going somewhere that is exclusively designed for them and has the treatment programming that has been catered specifically for them. Other advantages would be, each and every day, we work with fire departments and administration and local union leadership peer teams across the country. And definitely there are unique differences in how operations are in different parts of the country, but we have that expertise in knowing the language to work through specific requirements of workman's compensation, return to work policies, navigating these situations with expertise that other treatment programs could work through, but it would take additional learning, whereas we already know that language and we've successfully been able to work through these type of situations for 6.5 years. having the ability to build on the camaraderie that is already on campus through the brother and sisterhood of the fire service. And we know that the fire service is so unique with having that camaraderie and being able to utilize that in treatment. I've heard time and time again from Center of Excellence alumni that have shared with me, you know, of course, the clinical programming is, you know, they've had wonderful things to say. And of course, it's been able to really put them on the road to recovery. But they highlighted how so much of the treatment process for them was doing it alongside the brothers and sisters of the fire service and sharing that relatability and going into individual and group sessions with that guard down. You know, I don't have to explain what chain of command is and why it's important. I don't have to explain why I have these specific, you know, traumas or why this is going on or why I have anxiety about certain situations, because they already are aware. And although I'm, you know, each individual has a case by case type of situation and we do look at everyone on an individualized basis, there is a thread of connection between fire service members, and it's something that is understood on campus. Clinically as well, our medical and clinical team are aware of, you know, sleep, for example. We are not going to recommend the same sleep habits that we would recommend a civilian, because it may not be doable for a fire service member that is still in active duty on the job. We have to come up with different strategies, as well as looking at medications and knowing what medications short-term and long-term can fire service members be on and still effectively, safely do their job versus other programs or clinicians that may not have as much of awareness of the limitations or the need to be more mindful of medication management and making sure that those safety issues of the job duties are acknowledged. That's something that our team has a lot of awareness and ability to work through and maintain that functioning on the job for the individual. I would say disadvantages. You know, let's say an individual, they have a specific trauma trigger that is related to the fire service. And maybe being on campus where it is designed like the fire service from our residential beds are called station houses, station house 1, 2, 3, 4. Our dining room is set up like a firehouse kitchen with long family style tables. And so it does have the design and the environment to be welcoming and familiar for fire service members. But that may be a disadvantage of it if an individual's trauma is rooted. Maybe
It could be a trigger.
It could be a trigger. Sure.
Okay.
It's not something we've heard often. We definitely mostly do hear it's more of a positive of having that comfortable, familiar environment. But I could see how that could be a disadvantage there.
How do you screen for are there firefighters that try to admit themselves for treatment in order to avoid a disciplinary issue? Do you find that?
So I will say oftentimes we see the start or the prompt for somebody to reach out for treatment maybe will come from the layers of different things going on, such as possibly a disciplinary issue. Maybe it's a DUI. Maybe their wife or their spouse filed for divorce and they're recognizing, I now need to do something. So we definitely see that there are individuals coming to us with legal issues or disciplinary issues, but that may just be a layer as to why maybe they were prompted that they maybe need to pursue some treatment. Now, I will, and more of a realization for needing to come to treatment.
Okay.
But if an individual is facing a disciplinary action, we will do what we can as long as we have a release of information signed to, you know, communicate back home if needed to move things along or to assist them with that disciplinary issue if that does exist. But we have to maintain strict confidentiality that we only operate and provide information that the member is comfortable with us providing if so. But I will say if there is a specific disciplinary action, most of the time we don't see that it would be eliminated by coming to treatment. They may come to treatment and really resolve the behavioral health needs that maybe sparked that disciplinary action. But then oftentimes once they do return home, depending on the situation, they may have that disciplinary, action occurring from whatever that behavior may have been waiting for them when they come back. And we'll do what we can to support. But you know, sometimes those things happen. But I will say sometimes it is the spark to the realization that maybe treatment is a step that would be helpful, not only for their health, but maybe their marriage, maybe their job and other situations like that.
Let's say I'm someone who's thinking, okay, maybe I've got something going on. I need to get help. I need to, you know, take this next step, but I'm worried about how's that going to look to my brothers and sisters at the firehouse? How's that going to look to the administration? What do you say to somebody like that who's, you know, maybe recognizing they've got something going on, but they're, you know, they're basically concerned about the consequences or the perceived consequences of getting help.
Sure. So I'm going to break this into two parts, because the first part, I will say, in terms of our communication of anything related to them coming to treatment or anything related to that, we take confidentiality very seriously. If an individual does not want anyone to know, from the firehouse, from their union, even from their peer team, even we do not have liberty to disclose that the individual is even coming to us without a release of information clearly stated. So any information shared would only be with approval from the individual, or from them sharing themselves. Now, in terms of that fear of coming back and kind of the ramifications of that, we see there's a much higher chance of a positive outcome of coming into treatment to deal with what's going on versus continuing to kind of sweep it under the rug, maybe self-soothe with substances and continue to kind of prevent or avoid treatment. We do see that that ends up in a higher likelihood of disciplinary action or substance abuse concerns or risk to self or others when they're more in a position of not seeking that treatment. So we try to help them to navigate, you know, what are these concerns? How can we help mitigate these concerns and help, you know, support you through that? And do you have a peer team that we can support you with once you return home and really just back from treatment to help with those concerns? But I will say most of the time we are seeing evidence that although coming to treatment is a big step, and there's a lot of question marks of what that looks like coming home, there's most commonly a higher likelihood of a positive outcome for long-term recovery and long-term wellness and long-term job effectiveness and satisfaction versus kind of muddling in the middle and continuing to kind of sweep away these behavioral health concerns that we may have, which over time may then result in higher issues, either disciplinary issues, job-related issues, marriage-related issues, that sort of thing. But we do take confidentiality very seriously, and we only provide information to department, administration, local individuals that we have the ability to do so through a release of information.
Great. Thank you.
I have just a few more questions. So what's a typical stay? Like, how long does somebody stay? And then what can they expect? Because, you know, you spoke a little bit about admissions and insurance and what the dining situation is like. But what, like, groups, programs, is there yoga? Is there, you know, what are they, what can they expect when they're there?
Absolutely. So each individual comes on campus to their treatment plan is definitely individualized. So we cannot definitely say how long their stay will be because that is a decision that is created between the client, nursing staff, clinical medical staff, making sure that that treatment plan is setting them up for the best outcome upon going home. But we will say the average length of stay is about 35 to 45 days. So that does set the individual up for the highest potential of a positive outcome upon coming home and assimilating back into society once they do come home. So different treatment modalities that we do utilize on campus include EMDR or eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, cognitive behavioral therapy or CBT, cognitive processing therapy or CPT. We have family counseling and family psychoeducation. So when an individual is on campus, we do have HIPAA-compliant video, Zoom-related video conferencing so that the spouse or the family back home can be kept up to date on the treatment progress, and they can be sure that they understand how can I best support my spouse or this member when they come home in providing that psychoeducation. We also have biofeedback available off-site, pain management. We have a program for sex addiction recovery. We have yoga, equine therapy. We have Alcohol Anonymous meetings on campus, smart recovery concepts, recreational therapy, pastoral care, as well as other individual and group modalities that are utilized on campus. But it is definitely a structured programming environment. Individuals are coming onto campus for treatment, and they definitely have the mix of individual and group, and depending on what level of care they're at, and they do navigate through those different levels of care, determines how many hours a day of programming they'll be each day in their routine.
Fantastic. Well, we've covered a lot with you, Hannah, and you know, clearly you're a rock star in how you deliver this information. It's so impressive. And just wanted to ask you, is there anything that we didn't mention that you wanted to bring up or talk about?
Sure. So one thing that we want to be able to help with fire service members and their families with as well is connection to local outpatient resources too. Mm-hmm. We recognize that not everybody is looking for inpatient treatment today, and maybe not ever, but maybe a therapist or opening up to a behavioral health resource at home might just be what somebody's looking for. We take very seriously the need to vet clinicians for cultural competence. Not every single mental health clinician is equipped to be of the best service for fire service members and their families. And we want to be sure that we connect an individual with a clinician that is not only trained and credentialed and has that certification in working with first responders, but truly has that competency and that immersion and that experience to be able to best meet that need. So if that is a need, and if somebody says, hey, I maybe don't need to come to the Center of Excellence, but I'm looking for some type of behavioral health resource. I'm ready to start therapy. I don't even know where to begin. There's so many different therapists out there and expertise. And I've never done this before. Let us help take that responsibility and help you with that. There's all different types of therapists out there, but what we're looking for is, are they licensed? Are they credentialed? Do they have specific training in evidence-based approaches that are deemed effective for fire service members? And let's get you guys connected. So we work on a nationwide basis to identify local resources, meet with them, vet them for cultural competence, and then we can connect that with you for yourself or for your spouse or even for your kiddo, if that's a need that we can help with, so that you have that trusted resource to lean on back home. And so I will say sometimes peer teams are doing their own work in finding their own list of culturally competent clinicians. Mm-hmm. And they want to begin that vetting process. On the IFF Center of Excellence website, under the resources tab, there are plenty of printable resources to be able to utilize as handouts in your peer team. And one of those is helpful tips to vet your own clinician. So if you identify, hey, here's a clinician, maybe they're new or maybe they just moved here, we don't really know them. There are a list of questions that can be utilized to help break down whether or not this individual could be a good fit for your members. In addition to that, there's other resources on the resource page, such as how to talk to kiddos about going away to treatment, how to support peers going away to treatment, FAQs about treatment, insurance questions. All things under the sun related to behavioral health resources are available to utilize as printouts for your team. And then, like I said, we're here to help with any type of behavioral health resource, whether it's inpatient, local, education, or just assistance with answering questions. We are genuinely here, and I mean it in all sincerity, that we want to help. Contact information is here. And if we're not the best fit or answer to your question, we will find somebody that is and make sure that we get your questions answered and that resource need met.
And please share with us, how can people get in touch with you and the IAFF Center of Excellence?
Perfect. So the IAFF Center of Excellence website is IAFFRecoveryCenter.com. On there, there's admissions numbers, there's information about behavioral health and different resources available on there. Like I said, our admissions number is a 24-hour number that you can call as well, 855-441-3024. My personal cell phone number, I would love, in all sincerity, for you all to utilize it if needed as well to reach me. It's 727-506-9036. You can reach out to me via email at helmore@advancedrecoverysystems.com. I'm also on LinkedIn. If you want to follow me on there, Hannah Elmore, MSW, working at the IFF Center of Excellence. I'd love to connect and continue the conversation there.
Fantastic. And you're out there doing outreach, I know, because we connected in Orlando at a conference. You're out there meeting green people in person, which is, I think, is huge as well. So, Hannah, thank you so much for all you're doing for firefighter wellness and also for being our guest here today on Respond to Resilience. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful sharing this morning with you all, and I look forward to continuing the conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Please like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and Responder TV, PBSRadio.com, all the podcast platforms, and check out our website for past episodes and guest information. It's ResponderTV.com. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself. Take care.